Good morning, everyone. Good morning. We're going to get started. I don't know if it's just me. I might be projecting, but it feels like a very sleepy morning, which is always good. So hopefully we can get riled up here together. Well, welcome to Redeemer's very last Sunday at Trinity. And more specifically, to the last Core at 9 in this room. I can't say I'm going to miss it very much. I went to this seminary, so it always feels like seminary being here, which is not exactly what I think we're going for. I don't know, Amanda can confirm or deny. I had many classes in here, up and down this hallway. What's that? Man, you got to be right on this thing, huh? Oh my gosh. I feel like a rock star. Thank you. All right. Yeah, so let's go have Core at 9 in a church from now on. Starting 2 weeks from today. Not next week. We're taking a break next week. Well, if you've been following along in this study, you're hopefully starting to get a picture by now of the Epistle of 1 Peter. We've been focusing on different themes each week. Dana talked about election. Amanda talked about the land and exile a few weeks ago. Last week, Dana taught us about suffering. And I hope that as we look at the book from these different perspectives, a bigger picture is starting to come into view. We're not working through the book verse by verse, chronologically, which could be great as well. But hopefully this approach will, as we put another piece into the puzzle each time, the whole picture starts to come into view. That's the idea. So this week, we are focusing on Peter's understanding of salvation. And I trust that this will further broaden and sharpen our picture. I also hope, by the way, that you have found time, as Amanda and Dana have sort of reminded us to do, to sit down on your own and just read the book of 1 Peter. It's very short. It won't take you long. I do think, at least speaking for myself, I tend to think of Bible reading as something you do just like little tiny chunks at a time and you work your way through. It's really good to just read whole chunks of it. In fact, in the last few years in my own reading, I've started to lean toward just reading longer chunks and just reading through a book like pretty quickly, like several, like a few chapters at a time. And what I found is it's a little bewildering because you're reading over stuff that you don't understand and you're just plowing on and you're like, well, I really didn't know what that passage was all about. It's really disconcerting how often that happens to me. But what I think there's a real benefit to it as well, and to read quickly and get a big picture. And 1 Peter is a really short book anyway, so it's not like we're not talking about Isaiah or something. But yeah, I hope you have found time to do that, because if you haven't and you're just coming to these talks, we're very glad you're here. But I think it might feel a little more disjointed and sort of disparate if you haven't just read 1 Peter. So I hope, and do it again. If you've done it already, do it again. The picture we are starting to see is of a people, a chosen people, called, like Israel, to be holy and to be different from the other nations. 1 Peter 2, verse 10 describes them, us, as a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. This chosen people is characterized by their obedience. They're also described as exiles and foreigners, people whose citizenship, whose primary identity markers, are in heaven. To quote Hebrews 11, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. You actually get points in Core at 9 for quoting Hebrews. We keep score. But that's not obviously 1 Peter, but as I was preparing this talk and even in the other lessons, that verse kept coming to mind. It's a good sort of corollary to the whole book of 1 Peter. So from Hebrews 11, when all those people in the hall of faith, as it's called, were longing for a better country. And because of our new identity, we will inevitably suffer, as Dana talked about last week. And what Peter seems to have in mind, especially, is not just the kinds of suffering we normally experience in life, from sickness or natural disasters. He seems to be especially thinking of the sufferings that these people, his readers, are coming into because of their faith, specifically. So he calls them the sufferings of Christ, or suffering in chapter 3, I think, for what is right. That's a theme in Peter, for sure. And Jesus is our example in that, because he suffered what he did not deserve to suffer. He suffered what was right. It's not that those other kinds of suffering that we all experience can't also be redemptive and can't also be used by God and become meaningful in our lives. But Peter is especially thinking about this kind of suffering, I think, which prompts a very interesting question. How are we suffering for our faith? We'll talk more about that later. But certainly the recipients of this letter knew something about that. And Peter wasn't just talking to himself. There was a very particular context for that talk. So, salvation in 1 Peter. There are two main passages we are going to focus on as we discuss this theme today. Salvation is really woven through the whole book. It's one of those concepts that's just, you know, it's all about salvation, kind of. But there are a couple places in particular where it's really in focus. So we're going to read those, first of all. They're quite well-known passages. Lots going on in them. It's interesting. We tend to know a lot about how Paul describes salvation. Paul's language and metaphors have become the primary ways we talk about salvation in the church, and that's a good thing. Paul certainly wrote a lot more about it in our New Testament than Peter. But here we have Peter's perspective, which is a little different than Paul's. It's not in conflict. It's not a completely different vision. He actually uses some of the same language, some of the same metaphors. But it is a different perspective maybe than we tend to focus on, not just in our like sermons and stuff, but even just in our own mental map of it. And so that's one way we can maybe approach this morning. Scripture gives us lots of different metaphors and images and ways to understand what salvation is. And it's still not exhausted. The topic is not. In fact, for all the good and appropriate ways we have to think about it, it remains inexplicable, beyond our comprehension, mysterious. We do have good ways to think about it that will keep us busy our whole lives long, but it's still beyond us. And so that's one reason why I think Scripture gives us different perspectives and different ways to think about it. So this is how Peter talks about it in his first epistle. So what picture do we get of salvation in Peter? Let's read. There are two passages, so I would like, if possible, two readers. Any volunteers? Lizzie's not here, so we're down one. Leslie, thank you. And one more? I don't mind picking somebody. Chelsea, thank you so much. So if Leslie could read chapter 1, verse 3 to 16, a little bit longer, and then verse 3 to 16, and then if Chelsea would read chapter 3, verse 18 to 22. And I think I listed that on your outline, so you should have it. Okay.
Show that your faith is genuine. It is
Thank you. Leslie? Yeah, whenever you're ready, Chelsea. Thank you. So a lot going on in those verses, a lot of things that have been pretty controversial. We're not going to deal with everything. If you were hoping I would explain what Peter means by Jesus went and preached to the imprisoned spirits, you might be a little disappointed. I do have thoughts if you want to ask later, we're not going to solve that mystery today. To get into these passages a little more, we're going to break up into groups. If we could do five groups, and then we'll each take a few verses and ponder them together. So, John and Joel can be a group. Four ladies there, group two. Jenny and Dana. I mean, I could just let you guys split off and just trust you guys to find five groups. Would that be easier? All right, do that. You do well, once you're grouped off, I'll assign passages. So we got one, two, three. It seems so simple when other people do it, but it's hard. We can do that. Well, yeah, it's going to be hard, but it's fine. It's no big deal. All right, so if you... It's fine. We'll survive. No, it's fine. Okay, so if Amanda, Joel, and John would take chapter 1, verses 3 through 5, Nicole and your group could take 1, 6 through 9, Wade's group can do 123 to 125, and then I do want someone to do three, so you guys get the fun job. This is the hardest group, the hardest passage, I think, but you guys are up to it. Yes. So I have questions written, and let me just go through them real quick, that I'd like you to use to get into it. What are some of the key metaphors and images for salvation in your passage? Some of them you'll recognize from elsewhere in Scripture, but just kind of list them out and maybe use that as a way to get into it. And then a really interesting question, which we're going to build on, is salvation spoken of primarily as past, present, or future event in your verses, or some combination of? Is there anything in your verses that relates back to our themes of election, of exile in the land, or of suffering? Some do more with those than others. Don't force it if it's not there, but see, ask yourself that question. And then finally, anything else you notice that stands out? If you have some interesting observation that doesn't fall into my little rubric, then please share. All right, so let's take about, let's do 5-10 minutes, and we'll see how it goes. Short on time.
Thank you. I feel better already.
maybe just a couple more minutes, and then we'll come back and share. All right, I'm gonna call us back to order. I'm sure you guys could talk a lot longer. I gave you a lot to do, but in the interest of time, we're gonna keep rolling along. Let's go around, and you guys can share some of what you just talked about. There's no right answers, but there are wrong answers. Something like that. No pressure. So let's start up here with our group here to my left. What'd you guys find in chapter 1, verses 3 to 5?
talked about the image, a couple images, one of new birth, and a new birth into a new realm.
Okay.
And the image of inheritance. Those are the images that we saw. For past, present, future, we saw kind of new birth is kind of something that's already happened. It had been given a new birth, and yet at the same time, it's something that is stored up and is going to be revealed. So there's this past and present reality, but also a very much a forward salvation, something that's not here totally yet.
Yes. Hints. Yeah.
It's not a slam dunk.
Yeah.
And then with suffering, just the contrast with those inheritance that can't perish or spoil or fade.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Well, thank you. Certainly, the inheritance is one we'll talk about a little bit more. But yeah, I have a few just notes here, and you guys are right where I was. So thank you. What about this group down here? Precious and being refined. Yep.
And then also, you had joy. In the context in which it is here, probably speaks to the most, but it's talking about inexpressible joy of this inheritance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the kind of past, present, or future for salvation. You're seeing that in verse 9, basically, it talks about receiving the end result of your faith. That receiving is currently happening and ongoing. So, present and future. And then for the themes of election, for suffering, I mean, this whole grouping of things does relate to suffering in a big way. One of the things that stuck out to us is in verse 7 is really an explanation of the trials that were experienced in verse 6. This is why this is happening. This is to, it's a fulfillment. You haven't seen him. These things have come to prove the genuineness of your faith. So there's, in some ways, it's comforting because we have that explanation of, hey, you're going through something difficult, these trials, yet know that there's a purpose for this. And then the other thing was, we were seeing kind of that concept of still ramifications with the trial of the exile, still suffering through Syria.
Yep. Great. Yeah, salvation as a crucible. And this is one of the places we see suffering most clearly, that we're being refined and waiting for something future that's going to come. So thank you. Yep. All right. How about... Which we could link back to these folks versus the inheritance being imperishable or kept in heaven for us.
Yes, definitely getting there. Thank you.
Sorry, Wade. Yep. And a living hope is in there as well somewhere. Yep. No, I don't. It's earlier. I don't think it's in your verses, but yeah. Thank you. All right. And I gave the hardest passage to this group up here. So I'm excited to hear what you guys discovered. Yeah. Thank you for doing that. Gesundheit.
So the idea is this salvation history, right? There's this going on, and that
All right. Well, thank you. I didn't use that word, that German word, in all my preparations. So you guys didn't even run across it. So congratulations. There's a lot going on in that passage, and thank you for that summary. I would like to spend a little more time on it, but we are short on time, and I want to blast through some of my notes here. So if you could stay with me for a few more minutes, and I'll try and get through as much of this stuff as I can, and try to get us to church on time. Two main threads I want to pull on that I see kind of throughout all these passages in different ways. First is something that we've kind of been talking about, and that's Peter's very future orientation of salvation. It's not the only way he talks about it. He also talks about it as something past, something present, but he is very interested in the future. Something promised, but not yet fully received. So in verse 5, the inheritance kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. Chapter 1, verse 8 and 9, though you have seen him, though you have not seen him, you love him. Peter had seen Christ in his life, but these recipients of these letters had not, presumably. Even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with inexpressible and glorious joy, for you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. So that's like present and future. Verse 13, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Christ is revealed at his coming. Look forward. Also verses that talk about salvation as something accomplished. Certainly, you were redeemed in verse 18. Verse 23, you have been born again. This is the familiar already not yet of New Testament theology. But Peter's orientation seems to skew toward the future, not only in these verses, but in the other themes of the letter that we've been talking about in our study. So what we're finding is Peter's treatment of salvation maps onto the themes we've already begun to see in the letter. We are people in exile waiting for the time when we can be brought to our true home. We suffer because we are stranded in a strange land among people who can't understand us and who often despise us. Our suffering refines us. This is the crucible. Preparing us for an event still in the future. We are people called out of this world and already belonging to a place that has not yet been fully established. So I'm going to blast on to inheritance, which is really the same theme, but it's kind of a metaphor that really gets at it. And this is closely linked to the future orientation salvation. Peter pictures our salvation in the first verses of chapter 1 as an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you. We are like people who have been guaranteed an inheritance. The will has been made out. It's been notarized. Official. It's all set. Ready to go. But, I don't want to stretch the metaphor too far, but hopefully, I think this is helpful. The rich uncle has not died yet. The inheritance is certain. This is the idea of hope in the New Testament. It's not just like, man, I hope this happens, but it is confident in its object, but it hasn't yet been delivered. Imagine you had such an inheritance coming, but in the meantime, you were still quite poor, maybe even struggling. Now, again, I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this metaphor, but imagine that you know an inheritance is coming beyond anything you can imagine, but it's not all delivered yet. How would that change the way you live every day? Well, I mean, I don't want to downplay the fact that we also have received all the spiritual blessings of Christ in our life. There is an already. It's not like we have no joy, no confidence, no grace. We have these things, and yet we're also waiting. And that's the tension, right? But so I don't want to overplay or downplay the already, but there is a strong sense in which we are waiting for this inexpressible inheritance. Vast fortune. And there's more about the inheritance. It can never perish, spoil, or fade. Unlike earthly inheritances, which can lose their value, can be stolen, moths can break in and steal, ours is in heaven. It is both guaranteed to us and its worth is beyond price, and it cannot ever depreciate. This is a wonderful state of affairs. And this is literally true of each of us who are born again in Christ. And yet, it's also in verse 4, I think, 5, yet to be revealed. It's as if we have this wonderful inheritance promised to us, but we only still have a dim inkling of what it even fully is. We have some idea, certainly, but it's a little bit like Christmas. We're excited because we get to unwrap it and fully see it. It's yet to be fully revealed. Maybe we like snuck a little peek under the tree, but we don't really know what's under there fully. And so we're excited to see what it will be. This is the state we're in as Christians. Peter is encouraging these diaspora churches to understand their salvation as a future promise, an inheritance yet to come. Not to discourage them or make them worry that their salvation is somehow still up in the air. The opposite, in fact. He wants to encourage them to have confidence in what is as yet unseen because their situation right now is so hard, because they're suffering for their faith, because they're scattered, because they're homeless, they're exiles and strangers. And so if they didn't have this hope, they wouldn't be a people. This is their identity. And it's the same for us today. All right, I'm going to have to hurry. I'm giving an abbreviated version. Usually I'm like going through my notes way faster than I'd planned, but today we're running behind. So I hope that over the last few weeks we spent in 1 Peter, if you need to go, please, for the service. I'm not going to keep anyone. A unified picture of the church is starting to emerge. This picture of people who have been chosen by God, born again by his Spirit, given this new identity and new inheritance, but still foreigners, exiles in this world, strange citizens of another kingdom. And as a result of this new identity, we suffer for our faith. What I want us to think about as I kind of send us out here is specifically as Redeemer. Redeemer is by and large a pretty comfortable church. Okay, can I say that? We live in comfortable communities. There are exceptions to this, but by and large it's true. Comfortable communities, we're generally speaking pretty well off, have lots of privileges, insulated from much of the suffering of the world. It's not to say we don't still suffer. So this picture of exiles and strangers suffering for our faith, do you resonate with that immediately? Do you feel like, yes, that's how I feel? Or do you sometimes, does it feel like a bit of a disconnect? For me, it does sometimes. And I think it's worth asking ourselves, where are the parts that don't feel like a natural fit to my experience, and why is that? Peter was written to a particular people in a particular place, of course, but I want to suggest that this picture of the church is not just for the original recipients of this letter, but it becomes a paradigm for all the church in every place and every time down through the ages. And that means us as well. So if there is a gap there in our sense of, does this really apply to us in our particular situation here as a Redeemer on the North Shore? What are we missing? Where are the gaps? To get a little personal just for a second, I grew up in a very conservative Christian tradition where there was a great sense of the world as a frightening and wicked place, a place to be avoided. We had to keep ourselves separate and pure. And there was some self-righteousness there and legalism, and it was largely motivated by fear of what would happen if we were corrupted by these scary powers. So when I was a teenager, and I think many people from my sort of experience had this, I know this is true, so it's very typical, I pushed back on it. With respect to the music I listened to, the movies I would watch, the kinds of people I hung out with, my understanding of politics. But if I'm honest, at least to some degree, I was motivated by the desire to fit in to the world, to not be seen as strange or out of step. What does 1 Peter, with its talk of strangers, foreigners, and exiles, have to say to me? What about verses like, the world will hate you as it hated me? What about the way the whole New Testament talks about the world? There's a whole sort of biblical theology of the world that actually can make many people like me very uncomfortable, because we don't want to think of ourselves as that whole, like, the world language was used in my upbringing in a certain way, which I've reacted against. And have I swung too far in the other direction? If that makes us comfortable, if we're unwilling to be seen as strange and out of step, to be hated even, then we have some thinking to do, and maybe even some repenting to do. So I would love to take questions. We don't have a lot of time, though. So, Susan? Yeah, I certainly don't want to give the impression that no one redeemer suffers for their faith, or that our lives are all easy and happy all the time. Obviously, that's not true. I know enough of you well enough to know that's not true. But I do think it's worth thinking about our general situation, and however that applies in your own life. These words can be of great comfort to us when we're suffering. They're supposed to be that. But they can also unsettle us in helpful ways, I think. Yeah. 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 Yeah, we're not alone in exile. We are given to one another, that's for sure. I want to be really respectful of the service that's going to start in 5 minutes. So I know we could talk about this more. Feel free to talk to me later if you'd like. But I am going to dismiss us. So thank you for being here. And we'll see you guys in the new building.